Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Marty Bartholomew, and he'll be answering your most important questions on high country fly fishing. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Marty a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. The broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and then listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Marty Bartholomew about high country fly fishing. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, in the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and helped with the Striped Bass Game Fish 2006 Symposium in Foxborough, Massachusetts, just to name a few. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give back something to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Well, before we introduce Marty, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. And tonight we have a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and also a 1-year subscription to the Fly Fusion magazine. So you have 2 chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered for the drawing yet, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and click on the link that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Marty's latest book, Tying Flies Like a Pro, Compliments of Marty and Frank Amato Publications. Here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. This question will be about something that we covered during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and your location in that text box on our homepage. It's the same text box that you'll be asking questions in during the show. So pay attention closely during the show and use your best typing skills at the end, and first person that comes up with the correct answer will win. Our guest tonight is Marty Bartholomew. Marty was introduced to the sport of fishing at a pretty young age. He's not sure how old. When he started out, the one thing he was sure of is that he didn't catch many fish. His neighbor, Jim Wilburn, introduced him to fly tying, and shortly thereafter, they planned a quick bike ride after work up Waterton Canyon on the South Platte River. They strapped their gear to the bikes, hopped on, and rode the 6 miles to Strauchess Springs Dam, and after thrashing around a while and getting his fly on the water, then all of a sudden, there was his first trout on the fly, a 12-inch brown trout. After fly fishing in Yellowstone National Park and going through a box of flies, he felt that if he were to continue to engage in the sport, he would definitely need to start tying his own flies. So 4 months later, he showed some of his creations to Len Sanders at the Trout Fisher, a local fly shop, and Len saw enough potential to put him to work. They struck up a deal to deliver flies for equipment. Marty needed a new reel, so he agreed, and it would take 8 dozen gold-ribbed hare's ears to get a new Ross G2. Soon thereafter, Marty was teaching fly tying classes at many locations in the Denver area and continues to do so to this day. Marty continued to tie flies professionally, expanding to several shops in the Denver area, to Cold Springs Anglers in Pennsylvania, Hunters in New Hampshire, and at his peak, he was tying 1,500 dozen flies per year. That's a lot of flies. He started doing tying presentations and slideshows at the International Sportsman's Expos in Denver, and was on the pro staff of AK's tool company, traveling across the country promoting their line of fly tying tools. In there, somewhere, he actually did learn how to fly fish. His first book, Fly Fisher's Guide to Colorado, came out in January 1998 with broad acceptance and became a life-altering event for him. Since then, Marty produced a DVD called Fly Fishing Colorado's Major Six, and which came out in the winter of 2004. And it covers fly fishing techniques for the Arkansas, South Platte, Colorado, Gunnison, Frying Pan, and Roaring Fork Rivers, which are all in Colorado. In the fall of 2006, his next book, Tying Flies Like a Pro, was released. He interviewed and photographed flies tied by several professional tiers and came up with an outstanding inventory of fly patterns and ideas from some of the country's best. Marty Bartholomew has written stories for Trout, Fly Fish America, and Southwest Fly Fishing. He's currently on the pro staff for Ross Reels, Whiting Farms, and Scott Rods. Marty, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, good to have you, Marty. And that was a quite long introduction, and I cut it down by about three quarters, too. So quite the life history you've got there with fly fishing.
Well, I've been doing it for, 25 years. I ought to stack up a few accolades there and somewhere, huh?
Yeah, and a few stories in there, too, huh?
And a few
stories up there. Luckily, in Colorado, we have a lot of high country fishing, I know that's where you kind of cut your teeth on high country fishing. So tonight we're going to try to pick Marty's brain about what he's learned about fishing in alpine regions and at altitude, as I say. And right here in Colorado today, Marty's in Colorado too, and it doesn't look like a very good day for high altitude fishing today. It looks like we're back to winter here. We're in the middle of a snowstorm. So, little spring flurries, huh, Marty?
Well, this isn't the best time to be in the high country anyhow. So, we need the snow. Any moisture we get is a godsend. So, we're happy to get it.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's for sure. Well, let's dig in here. Tell me a bit about just how you got interested in fishing the high country lakes and backpacking, hiking in, and why you like fishing them. Just give us a little background there.
Well, I backpacked in high school a lot. I fished, just with a MEP spinner and things like that with a small backpacking rig. And I enjoyed the high country, basically. And they're so close. I mean, every morning I wake up, I get to look at them, and just the chance to get up there was my motivation. I really wasn't very good at it at first. I just piddled around with it, didn't take it too serious, and then, started fly fishing, and it just seemed the next best thing to do. I was out there fishing all the big rivers, the San Juans, the Platts, and the Roaring Forks, and I always just enjoyed the solitude of the high country and getting out by myself or, with a friend, so... I pursued it.
And enjoyed every minute of it, I take it.
All except the last 5 miles out sometimes.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
I wish the car was a little closer.
Yeah. And the older you get, it's the harder it is, isn't it?
It is. It's harder and harder.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. Well, let's just talk about, the idea of backpacking and hiking in and try to, since you've done a lot of it, try to get a little feel for, what recommendations or tips you have on that before we actually get into the fishing. So do you have any suggestions about just backpacking equipment in general, gear that you like or like to take? Nathan Giles in Knoxville, Tennessee asked that question.
Okay. I still have equipment that I've had for years and years and years. So I'm sure that there's some new equipment out there that's probably far exceeds what I have. But I always like the internal frame packs. They just fit my body better. They're more comfortable than the hard frame metal. And you just got to learn how to pack light. I mean, I've whittled it down to the bare minimums at times, and sometimes you think you don't have enough, but when you get home, you have things in there that you just don't use. So you keep evaluating that. So it's going to be different for every person. I'm sure that you know, the next guy is gonna require something that I don't. So I would, you know, aside from other gear, you know, your basics, I would say a pair of boots is your most important. You know, you're on your feet pretty much all day. You know, you get the break when you start fishing, but then, you know, you're walking again. So boots are going to be the most important. Make sure they fit. They actually need to be like half size too big, I think. And I've had other, you know, backpackers and hikers tell me this, so hopefully I'm not leading anybody astray. But you need a boot that will not jam your toes, you know, and carry a little bit heavier pair of socks. You know, a good hiking sock now are a dime a dozen. I mean, you can find good socks anywhere. But when you're walking downhill, and you do a lot of that, even as you're going uphill, there are some of those downhill stretches. And when you're going downhill, your feet or your toes really can't be jamming up into the toe of your boot. So I would just suggest a little bit extra room in there. Other than that, you know, some of your basics are, you know, water filter, you know, a good water carrying device so that you can, you know, something that's comfortable, maybe not too big. You know, if you have a water filter, there's always little streams and stuff that you can pull water out of.
Right. Yeah, okay. You mentioned, you know, I do a lot of backpacking too and river running and so forth. And one thing that I found, a couple of things the past couple of years that I started using from, because I'm like you, I have a lot of gear from years gone past, but one is it's not a water filter, but a water sterilizing. It's called a SteriPen. You basically just wand it around in your water bottle for, I can't remember, 60 seconds or something, and it sterilizes the water. And it doesn't filter it, but if you're getting pretty clear water to begin with, it's a lot lighter to carry and a lot less bulky. And then this past year I picked up these, I can't remember what they're called actually, but they're bowls and plates and cups made out of plastic that fold flat, and then you fold them up kind of like origami, and you've got yourself a bowl and a cup, and they're super lightweight and really easy to pack too. So those were two things I discovered recently that I really like.
Those are very good ideas. Really, if you have good water, good clear water, Girardia is the only thing you need to worry about, and those wands kill Girardia. Is that right?
Yeah, they kill everything. They kill more than a filter does, actually. So
okay.
They use what is it? I can't remember what the ray is, but it's really pretty slick. I used it down
like
in the Grand
gamma
Canyon.
Gamma ray or something, or
ultraviolet ray.
Okay.
And that's what does it. But I've used it everywhere, and even my parents took it to Cambodia and used it there. So pretty good little system. Well, good. What about meals? Do you make your own? Take prepared packages? Again,
I'm,
that's a packing issue, huh?
I'm very much a minimalist when it comes to food. I take oatmeal. Oatmeal seems to be, you know, a good boost for me, and it's pretty light. You just mix water, heat your water up, and put it in there, and you're going. You got a nice hot meal. I do use some prepackaged, you know, boil the water, put it in there, or, you know, things like that. Power bars, you know, what I used to carry a lot of was just a power bar. Now there's so many different kinds that it gives you a good variety. But I'm really a minimalist. I fish, I eat just a little bit, I sleep, and I get up and do it again. So.
Yeah, well, my problem is I like to take a good book to read, my fishing gear, plus my camera, and by then I'm, you know, it seems like I just had another 15 pounds, you know.
Yeah, food, I mean, you got to have the food, but I'm, you know, I know how much I can eat and sustain myself, and I don't have to gorge out and take too much. If there's anything that I found early on, I carried way, way too much food. I always had food left over. I was carrying it back out. So
yeah,
that's an area that I've really cut back on.
One question came in here, Jeff, and one of the things before I ask the question is that you said earlier, I think is a great tip that I'm going to use next time is, you know, when I come back, say, what didn't I use, you know, and start taking things out because, you know, that could be a good indicator as long as it's not rain gear and it didn't rain or something like that. But I think that's a good approach. Jeff Moody in Houston, Texas, have you incorporated any of the ultralight techniques that are out there now?
As far as gear or or fishing gear?
No, I think he's talking backpacking there.
No. No, I haven't.
Okay. Okay, so you're pretty much a traditionalist, and but just go light, as light as you can with most everything. Then, right?
Yeah. And I didn't get, you know, a very large cubic inch pack. I mean, I that kept me from packing too much. And even at that, I put too much in. But I didn't get one of the huge backpacks also. That kept me from putting in too much.
Yeah, and Jeff, again in Houston, agrees with you. He says he probably knows something about this. You definitely want to size up in boots to allow for foot swell, too. So,
Yeah.
And I've been there. I've gotten blisters you wouldn't believe on a backpacking trip from bad boots, and it's no fun. Okay, let's talk about any things around safety. Did you take any survival gear? If so, what? And any safety tips as far as being in the high country you could pass on?
Well, I always carry a knife of some kind. There's some really good folding knives that are light now that work really good. I always take some form of first aid. I don't want to be left out without some sort of first aid. And you know, your water, it's just the water filter, or if you say these wands are the way to go now, you always got to have water. I can live for a long time with water, so that's survival. And some rain gear. I think if you can stay dry, you can survive for quite a while out there. So those are my three main things: a knife, first aid, and rain gear.
Yeah. Good. What about are you a hiker, or are you any mountain biking or horseback packing in on your trips?
I don't think I've ever been on a horse.
Ever?
My whole life. I don't think I've ever been on a horse. So that's definitely out.
Okay.
I have no desire to get on a horse either. And I really don't do any mountain biking. Just a few little trips here and there, but nothing into the high country.
Yeah, I know here in Colorado and probably in California as well as, some of the trails you cannot go on bikes anyway. You have to go on foot.
Right.
And many times that's a pleasure when you're the one on foot. It's nice not to have bikes going by. But and what about, are you fish solo with a buddy? How do you go in?
When I'm going up high, especially to lakes, I'm normally with somebody. I fish solo a lot if I'm just doing a day trip or a real quick overnighter on a small stream. If I'm going up high enough to a lake, I would normally have somebody. But, you know, like I said earlier on, I kind of like the solitude and being by myself and, you know, that communing with nature, if you want to call it that. But I would have to say that it's not all that safe, you know, to be by yourself. So, you know, I would say the buddy system is the way to go.
And have you done any really long extended trips, you know, week, 2 weeks, or anything like that?
Probably, you know, up to 4 or 5 days. I would say probably 10 or 12 in and 10 or 12 out, you know, as far as miles go. And that would be, you know, stopping at maybe 5 miles or something to fish and then, you know, doing overnight and going back in. I've never been a real distance guy, so.
Yeah. Good. Okay.
I found a lot of lakes that, 3.5 miles in, I can be in some really good fishing, so.
Yeah. Well, let's take a little break here. And then when we come back, we will dig into the fishing equipment and get your recommendations on that.
Very good.
The Platte River Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming features a first-class website covering all aspects of fly fishing the tailwaters of the North Platte River, including up-to-date local fishing reports, fly patterns, guide services, and online shopping for top-of-the-line gear for any travel destination. The Platte River Fly Shop provides a professional guide staff for the Blue Ribbon Trophy Gray Reef and Miracle Mile sections of the North Platte River. Visit their extensive website at www.wyotrout.com. That's wyotrout.com. Or call the Platte River Fly Shop at 1-307-237-5997. That's 1-307-237-5997. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Marty Bartholomew about high country fly fishing. If you'd like to ask Marty a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And, folks, I do appreciate you sending those questions in live online. That's great. Some of these I'm holding for later on in the show here, just to let you know, to where they fit in a little bit more into our agenda here. So hang tight. We'll get these answered and keep sending them in. We really do appreciate it. It makes the show much more interesting. Well, Marty, before we jump into the fishing equipment, tell us a little bit about what you're up to lately in the fly fishing world, and give us a little brief. And also tell us, on your most recent book, give us a little insight on how that book came about and why you did it.
Okay. Well, first, the Fly Fisher's Guide, which came out in 98, as you said earlier, I've just done my fourth revision on that book, and the new revision should come out maybe at the end of this month or mid-May. So if there's anybody that doesn't have that book, it would be advantageous to pick up one. It'll be just updated, new addresses and so forth. So it's on top of things.
That's the Fly Fisher's Guide to Colorado. Right?
Yes, the Fly Fisher's Guide. And the tying book, I always like the combination books of authors. There was a couple out early, The Masters on Nymph Fishing and The Masters on the Dry Fly, and it was a compilation of several different authors talking about those subjects. And then Jack Dennis came out with Tying with Friends, which passed along information from other people. Well, I knew a lot of fly tiers here in Denver, and then it ended up being across the country, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Florida. I've got people, tiers from there that contributed to the book. So it was an informational package that I was looking for. I wanted to pass along as much information as I could. And I'd talk to these guys, and I know their theories on tying and so forth. So that was kind of the gist of the book, and it just turned out really. I thought it turned out really good. I was very pleased with the information we got. The photography ended up being very good.
Well, I don't know how many flies you've got in here, but I mean, for the size of this book, it is just chock full of information. But you've got caddis, mayflies, midges, stoneflies, streamers, terrestrials, attractors, and even saltwater flies in here. And
right.
I don't know how many you've got, but it's a really incredible book.
I think there was close to 75 patterns, and I would say really about half of them had never been published before. They were new patterns that these guys had come up with. A lot of them people haven't seen before, and the technique to tying them is the big plus in the book. These guys have some great ideas on speed and consistency of proportion, and I've just had so many comments come back. Boy, I wish I'd have had this 5 years ago, or I wish I'd have had this when I first started or something like that.
Yeah.
So
oh good,
everybody likes it.
Yeah, congratulations on getting that published.
Thanks.
And you also have a DVD out.
I do have a DVD out. It's been out for 4 or 5 years now. It's the Fly Fishing Colorado's Major Six. Covers six of the major rivers in Colorado. But I would say more than anything, it's just my ideas on how to catch trout. It doesn't matter if I'm in Montana or Wyoming or Utah or even Florida. I think the techniques that I use on these streams will tell you how to fish just about everywhere. So I hated to limit it to Colorado, but it just seemed to fit my you know, the book and kind of fit my following. So that's why we named it that. But it's very instructional. Has some tying in it also. There's six flies in there, so it's jam-packed.
Great. Good. Well, let's dig into the fishing. And before I do that, I do have a message here. Phil Panko in Minnesota, he's got a tip here on blisters, your backpacking. Now, if this doesn't work, then you just contact Phil Panko in Minnesota and tell him about it. But good old duct tape, he says. Duct tape's to clobber them, but also to help heal them. And the best way to take it with you, he says, is to carry the duct tape is to just wrap it around your water bottle. And then when you need it, you can just peel it off, I guess, and apply where necessary. So a little tip from Phil there. That old duct tape, I'm telling you, it's you got to have it, you know.
Use it for everything.
Yeah.
He'll have to get back. Do you put it on before you get blisters? I mean, do you just put it on before you start hiking, or do you, the first sense that you have of getting a blister, do you put it on?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe he'll write us back here, but I usually use moleskin, which you can get at Walgreens, and it's a little bit probably it's softer and stuff, and I put that on first. I always put it on my heels just in case, and then that
before you get started?
Yeah. But moleskin works real good, too. I always carry that around. Once you get it, I think, I don't know, maybe the duct tape works after you get them, but I've found that once you get them, you're just going to be hurting.
Yeah.
There's no way around it.
Yeah, I was always late with the moleskin.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about fishing gear. We've got Jim in California wants to know, what characteristics should a rod for high country fishing have and why?
Yeah, I think you need a fairly quick rod, a good, strong, butted rod for a couple reasons. When you're up there and you're trying to make some long casts, you need that quickness. You need the rod to perform well for you. You need the butt section to be able to roll cast. You are in tight situations on lakes and streams, and I would just, you know, in fact, before I went up there, I would be practicing my roll cast. If you can't roll cast, you need to learn to really get into the high country and do well. You know, very seldom are you going to find this big open bank. Or that you're going to be able to wade out there in 2 feet of water and, you know, cast to your heart's content. It happens once in a while, but not very. So lengthwise, I would just say anything you're comfortable with. Even on small streams, I fish a four weight. You know, some people say, well, why aren't you doing a two or a three or something like that? And I say they're too flimsy. They aren't strong enough to make that critical roll cast that you need. You know, you might have to bomb it out there 30 feet, 40 feet, right down the middle of the stream. And I just never liked the feel of a light two or three weight rod. Four weights, good strong butt, and lengthwise, I would just say, you know, even 8.5, 9 foot, especially if you're going to do high mountain lakes, 9 footers, your best bet.
That's what I always seem to find myself on the bank, and there's trees right behind me, and then I'm looking out in the water, and the shallow, you know, there's this shallow ledge that goes out quite a ways, and then it has a drop-off, you know. And it always seems that it just seems to be out of my reach to get out close to that ledge, but you're right, a roll cast, I guess that's all you can do, right?
That's your best choice. You know, there is a cast that you can kind of do side to side to side and then just kind of tail it back behind you and go forward. But that one, you know, unless you've really practiced that a lot, that can get you into messes, you know, where you're spending more time undoing knots than you are fishing. So
Yeah.
Simple. Keep it simple.
One thing, we got a question here from Sydney while we're talking about rods. Sydney wants to know, do you take a case for your rod? Seems like a lot of extra weight, or, you know, do you have another way to protect it?
Well, I had, in fact, I still do, a 9'5" weight metal case. And it was an old, I think it was an old Loomis, one of the first rods I ever got. I used it for a walking stick. I just carried my rod in it and used it as a walking stick. So,
you mean like a case for a two-piece rod, you mean?
Yeah, two-piece rod.
Yeah.
That's, like I said, 25 years ago. They didn't hardly make four pieces.
Yeah, right.
That worked out good. I didn't have to strap it on, and it may have been a little bit heavy, but it just came in handy as a stick.
Yeah. And then what do you do now?
I just carry a four piece in its case, wrap it on my backpack.
So, Okay.
But the cases aren't very heavy anymore. I mean, you know, you're really not talking about much weight. I don't think it's too much of an issue anymore.
Okay, another question, John French in Southern California. Marty, thank you so much for being on the show tonight. Planning a trip into the Golden Trout area this summer. Do you have a favorite line size, leader size, and length? So maybe you could kind of tell us what type of line you use and how you rig up.
I'm pretty stubborn about that. I very seldom use a sink tip line. I do carry one, but size-wise, I'm just using a four-weight floater. Sometimes if I know I'm going to be fishing a lot of small streams, I'll do a five-weight line on my four-weight, which just makes the rod load quicker. You know, if I'm only making 20 or 30-foot casts, that five-weight just seems to load the rod and be a little bit more precise. Leader size, very seldom do I buy leaders. Now, do I buy leaders that are less than 4X? So most of my leaders are either 7.5-foot or 9-foot, 4X. Now, I may taper that down a little bit, you know, to 5 and 6X if I need to, but I've just over the years, even with fluorocarbon, you know, you're probably going to get a lot of calls on this one, but I don't use fluorocarbon hardly at all, and I just don't seem to have any trouble catching fish. So I don't get into the fluorocarbon if you think the water's clear and it's going to help you, you know, have at it, or if you have confidence in fluorocarbon, go ahead. But the other thing about casting, you know, you might be trying to cast a long ways, you know, on some of these lakes. The 7.5-footer is just much easier to cast than a 9-footer. You have to be a little bit more precise. Your timing, you know, all those trees back there that you're worried about casting into and so forth become an issue. So I try to keep the leader as short as I possibly can, 7.5-foot, 9-foot at the most. If I need to go longer, I will, but I just don't if I can keep from it.
Okay, so if you have the shorter rod and you overweight the rod with 5-weight on a 4-weight, is that your best solution when you're roll casting as well, to try to, you know, to load that rod up quickly on a roll cast?
Yes.
Okay.
It works both ways.
Okay.
I don't know if you've ever tried that before, but it's worth giving a shot.
Yeah. Okay, this just in from Phil Panko again. Okay. Phil listens to a lot of our shows, so he says that he's heard that it can either not only prevent them before they start, but the chemicals in them can heal them as well. Now, I'm not too sure about that, Phil, but he says it also works well for fire starting, very flammable. So there's an
really?
Even additional tip there on fire starting. Yeah, I never thought of that. So,
try that.
I'm telling you, that duct tape, I can't do without it. Okay. So I think we've got the rod and line pretty simple set up, nothing fancy up there, right?
Yeah, and, keep it simple. You know, do things that you know how to do. I don't think you have to change your tactics, you know, that much just because you go, you know, another 3,000 or 4,000 feet, you know, elevation. It doesn't make sense to have a whole new arsenal. I don't think so.
Yeah. Now, Here's a question. It says, my fishing vest weighs a good 10 pounds. What are the absolute essentials I need to bring?
My vest weighs 11 pounds, just to try to outdo this guy. When I go up, you know, my vest stays home. I very seldom carry the vest.
Right.
I have a shirt with two big pockets in it for my tools and my flies. And I usually can get by with one fly, you know, one fly box. I carry my tools on a lanyard now, so that eliminates a little bit. So I carry tippet, flies, and tools. That's it. I don't worry about all the other little gadgets.
Niceties, huh?
We're gadget maniacs.
Yeah.
Fly fishermen are. So you just have to release them. Let them go.
Yeah, good tip. Another thing, this is kind of probably not specific to high country fishing, but I'd sure like to ask the question, because this is from Cyril in South Africa. And he says, how do I prevent knots in my leaders? Knots everywhere. Thanks for a nice show. I think we all have the knot problem. You got any tips for that, Marty?
I think he's probably talking wind
knots, probably, huh?
Yeah, and we all get them. And I would say that if you're a good caster, your knots are going to be to a minimum. If you get a lot of knots, it is definitely, it's not the wind knot. Everybody calls them wind knots, but I agree with Lefty Cray when he says they're bad casting knots.
But it's easier to blame it on the wind.
I know it is, but Lefty likes to get in your face and tell you how it is. So it's a little bit of casting practice, and I would say more than anything, it's just the timing aspects of the rod changing direction. That's where the knots are going to come from. Is the change of direction from a back cast to a forward cast, or from a forward cast to a back cast. So the timing of letting the line, you know, really stretch out there and straighten out before you come forward is going to eliminate most of your knots. Now, if you want to just backpedal a little bit and maybe not make a perfect cast, if you'll just concentrate on making an oval motion, so your rod is going back kind of low, and then your arm picks up a little bit and goes forward, you have this kind of oval shape in your cast instead of the straight back and forth. And I think that will help not only with the dry fly, but with when you're fishing a lot of weight. If you're fishing split shot or a big fly like a woolly bugger, I think if you just work on making an oval type of shape, then eventually a good casting stroke can come out of that. So I would say practice. Get out on a lake in your backyard and practice casting.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
Try to watch a video. I think watching somebody cast is much easier than reading how somebody casts. It's just it's too hard for me to read about casting. I love to watch people cast, so maybe that'll help.
I think a couple of things, if you can, I think what helped me more than anything is to get with a professional instructor.
Yeah.
It's amazing what they can do with you in a couple hours, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, if you've learned on your own, then you probably develop bad habits, and they can help you get that corrected, too. It's worth the money, I think. Makes fishing a lot easier and more fun when you learn how to cast better. But. Well, let's talk about... Go ahead, Marty.
The less time you spend undoing knots, the more fun you're going to have, the more fishing you're going to get in. So
that's right.
It's kind of a vicious circle there. You got to learn a little bit before you can do. So,
well, let's talk about fish up there. What are the main varieties of fish that you fish for in the high country?
I've always fished for cutthroats and brook trout. I was a brook trout maniac. That's what took me up to the mountains more than anything was trying to find a big brook trout. The state record here in Colorado is like 7 pounds, you know, 6 ounces or something like that. I don't remember exactly what it is, but I've fished lakes where I've seen, you know, 4 and 5 pound brook trout come out of. So that's where I spent a lot of my time.
Okay, so obviously the altitude doesn't really stunt the growth of the fish up there, right?
No. If it's a good spring-fed type of lake, or it has a good source of water and food, you know, as long as a lot of these high mountain lakes over 10, 11,000 feet have scuds, you know, the freshwater shrimp, and that is a high caloric diet. It'll grow fish in a hurry. So,
one thing that I was maybe this is something that I heard, and I don't know if you know the answer or not, but when you're catching fish up at the out of the lakes and streams, that if it's got white flesh, then it was probably a stocker, and if it has pink flesh, then it's probably been up there a while because it's been feeding on the shrimp or the scuds. Do you know if that's true or not?
Well, I think if you filleted any stocked fish, it's going to be white. And I think even as they start eating just normal insects and getting a good diet, their meat will, or the fish flesh, let's just call it flesh, would turn pink, so, or at least pinker. But I think they are really bright orange, almost salmony color when they get to eating a lot of scuds. I do agree with that.
Yeah. Now, are most of the fish at the high mountain lakes, are they stocked, or are they reproducing natural? The brookies, are they reproducing naturally?
I think, you know, brookies are pretty much a natural reproduction. They don't do much brook trout stocking at all, but some of these lakes that have brook trout in them do have big rainbows. So the rainbows, I'm sure, were flown in. You know, they bring a plane in and, you know, dump a 100 fish in or something like that and see if they make it. And I think it's probably a little bit of both. But brook trout, I would say they're all native, you know, grown, if you will.
Right. Reproduce up there.
Yeah.
Now, in the high mountain lakes, do you find rainbows or is the altitude limit?
I have, and I know that they were stocked. It's just when the Division of Wildlife finds out that there is a good, healthy lake up there, it's deep enough, and it has a good food source, they'll go ahead and do some stocking, and then probably check on it every couple of years or something and see how they're doing, and maybe make a decision from there. I don't know what their schedule is by any means, but no, I've ran across rainbows in some of these lakes, especially on the flat tops. The flat tops is one of the areas that I spend a lot of time. So, you know, some of those lakes end up with rainbows in them, and I know that they had to have been flown in or something.
Yeah.
And good size, you know, 18 to 22-inch fish in these 11,000-foot lakes.
Wow. Yeah, that's a nice fish anywhere.
Yeah.
Well, we need to take a break, and when we return, we'll be talking more with Marty about fly fishing tactics for high mountain lakes.
Great.
Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. Keeney's Fly Shop has an extensive inventory and fly tying department and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's K-I-E-N-E.com. Or call Keeney's Fly Shop at 1-800-400-0359. Again, that's 1-800-400-0359. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Marty Bartholomew about high country fly fishing. If you'd like to ask Marty a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that text box, the Q&A text box on our homepage. And just put in your questions, send it along, and we'll try to answer as many of them as we can on the show tonight. Okay, continuing on, let's talk. Here's a little comment from Brian Dickey in Broomfield, Colorado. He says, Marty, not so much a question, but just a thought. Everyone talks about catching the biggest fish or about catching X number of fish on a certain day or even the biggest fish that they can land on the lightest tippet. Wouldn't it be cool to say that you've caught the highest altitude trout in the state of Colorado? Hi, if you know where that place is, let me know, and I'll slog up there with you this summer. Any comments, Marty?
I don't know. You know, I've been well over 11,000 600 feet and caught fish. So I don't know if there's some little pit up there at 12,800 that might have a fish in it. I don't know, but I think if it's deep enough and it has a good source of water that's going to maintain it all the time, there's probably no reason it couldn't.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm curious. I've never been fishing in the Himalayas, but there's probably lakes a lot higher than 12,000 there. I'd be curious to know more about that, considering they have base camps. Pardon?
I think they would live if they had food.
Yeah. Brian Whiting in Glenwood Springs asks, I've caught grayling in both Alaska and Yellowstone Park, but never in Colorado. What would you consider the two best high country lakes for grayling in Colorado? I don't even know if there are grayling in Colorado still. Are there? Do you know, Marty?
Oh, yes, there is.
There is. Okay.
My son and I go up to Joe Wright Reservoir every year. We've been doing it for quite a few years, which is at the top of Poudre Canyon, right up there before you go over Cameron Pass. Joe Wright has a ton of grayling in it. They're not real big. Right above there, Zimmerman Lake had the state record grayling. It was like 1 pound, 7 ounces or something for a long, long time. And they killed that lake and put greenbacks in there, and all those fish were put down into Joe Wright.
That's what happened. Okay, yeah.
The other lake that I know of, there are a couple more, but the other one that claims, I haven't been there but once, so I can't make a huge prediction here, but some of the local guys tell me that there is a state record grayling in Pearl Lake, which is up by Steamboat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I fished there. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's not back in either. That's just right by the campground there. Yeah.
Yeah, you can drive to these places. They're right there.
Yeah. Yeah. So, good. Well, let's talk about food and flies there, because we've got questions coming in. Everybody wants to know about flies. You've already mentioned shrimp or scuds as a primary food source at altitude. What other food sources can we look for there that we can try to imitate?
There's always going to be some sort of midge, and you can have calibatus, a couple mayflies up there pretty high. But as many lakes as I've been on, and even the streams up there, the food source, you don't see a lot of flying insects. They're probably in there. I would say the other main source of food is probably a leech. The scuds and leech are going to be, and midges. I haven't been any place I haven't found midges yet, but that's going to be a pretty popular food source.
I've also seen quite a few caddis up there in some of the lakes.
There are a few caddis, but not nearly as many as even some of the lesser mayflies, the calibatus or a trico or something.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's what I'll see on Joe Wright almost every August is a trico hatch up there that the grayling just go nuts for.
Now, the food sources have a lot to do probably with what kind of vegetation, if any, is in the lake, right?
Yes. And, the vegetation at real high altitudes is limited because there's such a short growing season. There's ice on the lake until, June, probably breaks up 1st of July, and then it's going to get frozen over again in October, November. So the sunlight, the sunlight's what grows the weed beds, and you're just not going to have much time for that, so...
Right. But just because it doesn't have weed beds doesn't mean that there aren't fish in the lake, right?
That's right.
Okay.
For sure.
Sue Monroe in Washington wants to know, what flies do you take? What's in your fly box? So obviously you're limited because of weight as to what you take up and in bulk. Do you have a backpacking fly box, per se?
I do, or I'll put one together before I go, and it consists of some pretty simple stuff. Woolly boogers. I always have a couple woolly boogers in it. And I have a tendency to fish pretty big stuff, when it comes to woolly boogers. I'm not afraid to, you know, throw a number 8 or a number 6 in there, you know, 3 or 4 or 5X long hook. Black, you know, maybe a little flash in them, but normally I stay away from the flash when I go really high. I just like to keep a nice, you know, dull black, you know, Willy Booger. The other flies that I always carry is a Parachute Adams in probably an 18 all the way up to a 12, probably 3 or 4, maybe a half a dozen of each. So that's, you know, a couple dozen flies right there.
And then
a rusty spinner. Rusty spinners they're just not a fly that the fish see even on normal water. So when it's up there, this fly that's laying dead in the water just seems to be a choice that they will come up and rise to. The other dry fly is a beetle. I don't know what it is about beetles, but on a high mountain lake, they really seem to like to come up for them. Then when it comes to nymphs, you know, the scuds, and make sure you tie your scuds on a straight shanked hook. Don't do them on a curved hook. Scuds are swimming in the water, and they're not curled up as they're swimming. They're out there very long. Again, midges, you know, that I can dangle under, a dry fly is good. And then what I use a lot of, and even in case of a scud, in place of a scud, is a soft tackle. I'll just do, you know, some peacock body, you know, olive body soft tackles. Put a little color on them, like a little red tail, a little red marabou tail, or an orange tail. Something that's got that red or orange is a trigger. I really think it's a strike trigger for a lot of trout. So I'm really pretty simple. I don't take a lot of stuff up, and I don't expect to need to, you know, just go through fly after fly after fly to catch fish.
Right, right. Do you think the fish are they less picky because they see less insect life up there? Or?
Yes.
Yeah?
I think it's almost a definite that they just see something swimming in the water, and they're attracted to it right away.
Well, and the brookies are brook trout are seem to be very voracious eaters, I've always found up there.
Yes.
They're always looking for a meal, it seems like.
Yes.
John French in Southern California again, what would be the best all-around top flies? I guess the ones you just mentioned would be those flies, right? Beetle.
The Willy Booger and the soft tackle for, you know, underwater fishing, and like I said, I'll make a little bit of a variety there. But then a Parachute Adams, a beetle pattern, and a spinner, that's got to be my top five flies up there.
Do you use a lot of dual fly rigs, dry fly with a dropper kind of thing?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
And what you said, you drop a midge off the back, or is that usually your dropper?
The midge, or, you know, a little beadhead midge, or the soft tackle, either one. And,
okay.
You know, the other thing when you're fishing a lake, you can set that dry fly out there and just let all the riffles kind of go away, and it's just sitting there, and then just give it a twitch, you know. You want to make it look like it's swimming, or, you know, running across the top of the water or something, and that's what will draw the fish to the surface. Just for a little trick there.
Yeah. Now, do you... I'm going to kind of move into some strategies and tactics here. Let's see. Let me see what's coming in here on the Internet, too. Let's see what kind of questions we have going here. Before we do that, these are kind of off-topic, but people would like your opinion, and then we'll get into some strategies here. Ed Hewden in Byfield, Massachusetts, since you started fishing at an early age, I assume fly casting, I will ask your thoughts on this. I have a 10-year-old fishing buddy that I would like to teach fly casting. Any tips on how to get a youngster started? He is quite a spin fisherman and loves the sport. He does have an interest in learning how to cast. I'm not pushing this on him. So any suggestions for teaching kids?
Well, when you teach kids, you want to spend just a little bit of time. You know, don't make it a half hour to an hour outing when you're doing the casting. Just spend 10, 15, 20 minutes, because that's their attention span. And if they want to play with it a little bit, you know, let them. But, you know, as far as instructing goes, you don't want to really try to hammer it in there for a long, long time. Just keep it simple. You know, try to get them to get a nice arc in the rod and just show them the movement, and then let them play. I've seen kids just kind of pick it up and have a feel for it for themselves.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I recommend too is, just so that they have some success, is if you can take them to, you know, even a warm water lake where there's, like, you know, bluegills or something like that, that they can at least get them on the rod. You know, that gives them some encouragement too, I think.
I was relating to the casting, but fishing wise,
yeah.
I would always take them to something simple like that. Yes.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, where they can have some quick success and then
get
the bug, so to speak. Yeah. Again, Ed has another question. I have a small fly tying business that I started in October of 2007. I'm doing pretty well with my flies. I've been tying for over 30 years. Started when I was a kid. Can you offer any advice on how to expand my fly tying business?
Well, it really ends up being word of mouth. You're going to have to, show your flies to a lot of people. Even some of the online stuff, if you can manage the price points. But there's a lot of overseas flies coming in, and the cost, you know, that's what the fly shops are looking for, is a good cost. And when they can get, you know, flies, you know, these hundreds and hundreds of dozens at a time for a discount, it makes it kind of hard for the individual to produce enough to, you know, get the price point that they can still make money and the fly shops are happy with. But there are a lot of fly shops, believe me, around the country that want local tires. They want the American flies tied. So it's just a word of mouth. You know, let everybody know that you are a fly tire and see what happens.
Yeah. And it is highly competitive nowadays when you've got people in Kenya and Thailand tying, and it's hard to beat those prices. So
yes,
those people are working for pennies, you know, and it's hard to do that here. Yeah. A couple things about locations. We've got some questions about locations here. Do you find fishing the waters in national parks better or outside the park?
I would say probably on the average, they're probably better. I think they're managed a little bit better. And a lot of the national parks, people are coming in to see the national park and not necessarily do fishing. They're gonna hit the little streams, you know, like Rocky Mountain National Park, you know, the upper Big Thompson flows through Moraine Valley right there, you know, that's gonna get hit quite a bit. But if you get on one of the trails and follow up, maybe even Fern Creek or, Roaring River or, you know, any of these where you have to get on the trail and walk into, your chances are going to be pretty good of hooking into some fish. And I think the same goes for, Yellowstone or, Glacier.
A couple other things about, here's another park one. Can a person hike and camp in the high country on your own in Yellowstone Park? You're kind of just saying you can walk in, right? Or do you need an outfitter, he's asking?
I think you can. I don't know what the regulations are up there, but walking in Yellowstone by yourself is, I would say it's going to be a pretty risky situation. I would definitely have a buddy. I'd use the buddy system there.
Yeah, he was more asking, do you need an outfitter? You don't need an outfitter permit there.
No, I don't
there.
Think you need an outfitter, no.
Yeah. And another question here from Ted Hasselbring in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Marty. I love to combine fly fishing with backpacking. Can you recommend one or two places I might go out west?
Well, a pretty easy one to get to from Denver is just go up to Silverthorne, and there's several trails that go up into the Eagle's Nest Wilderness area and the Gore Mountain Range right there. That's, easy. I mean, if you get to Denver, you know, that's fairly easy to get to. Another one that I spent many, many miles in boots on is the Flat Tops, which is basically up by Steamboat Springs, And there's a lake up there called Stillwater Lake. It's at the very top of the Yampa River. That's where the Yampa River starts, basically. There's several trails that goes out of there. I'm not going to give you specific names of lakes, but if you find mine, so be it. But there are probably 10 trailheads that you can access from that one point, or very close to that point. And it puts you right up into God's country. I mean, it's just beautiful up there, and there's lakes after lakes after lakes sitting up there everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, both those areas are two of my favorite areas as well. Whether I'm fishing or not, those are great places to backpack, and
yes,
and there's plenty of lakes up there as well. But yeah, those are two of my favorite, very beautiful areas, definitely. And like you said, Phil Panko was asking, is there, you know, what's an inexpensive trip to come out to Colorado and go fishing? You probably just did it right there. There's a lot of places you can walk in, Phil, out here. And of course, Phil, you're such a good listener. If you give me a call, you could probably stay at my house and get it on the real cheap out here as far as fly fishing. So I'll extend you that invitation if you want to come out. Let's talk about, let me do one more break here, and then let's talk about some strategies and so forth. So hold tight for just a minute.
Okay.
Have you ever dreamed about the classic actions of bamboo fly rods? Did you know that it's possible for you to make your own bamboo fly rods? With the help of Power Fibers online magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod making techniques to stories about fishing bamboo rods to rod maker profiles to classic tapers, Power Fibers has it all. Visit our website at www.powerfibers.com. That's www.powerfibers.com for more information. We hope to hear from you soon. We're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Marty Bartholomew about high country fly fishing. If you would like to ask Marty a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and enter your question in the Q&A text box. We'll get the question immediately, and we'll try to answer it as soon as we can on the show. Another question here. Michelle Daniels in Boise, Idaho. Many high mountain lakes look barren, no weeds, just rocks. How do you know if they have fish in them?
Hopefully you can find that information out through local guides or local shops or some local people. Other than that, it's really trial and error. Charlie Meyer from the Denver Post asked me that one time, and I said that I have a gazetteer, a Colorado gazetteer. Everybody knows those maps, those map books that cover the whole state. I used to, find a blue line, which was a river, or a blue spot, and that was a lake. And I would find, a black line that was the road, and I would expect a bridge to be there. And if it was in the National Forest, I would just jump in that stream, walk up that stream or find that trailhead and walk into that lake and just go try them. And
uh-huh.
I've been on streams that look absolutely gorgeous, little beaver ponds and, everything, and there's just no fish in them. I was stomping through there trying to spook fish, and there's nothing in there. And then
yeah,
some raggedy-looking little thing that just has a few rocks in it, and I start throwing flies in there, and fish are rising all over the place. So it's trial and error, I would say, if you've got the time.
Yeah, I know one time when I was probably, 18, 19 years old, we backpacked in just kind of bushwhacking it, like you say, up in a steamboat area. Followed a stream up, got in this nice meadow. We got in kind of late. We just cooked dinner, put up our tent, went to sleep. And next morning, we hear splash, splash, splash. We look out the window of the tent, and there's fish just rising all over in this little tiny beaver pond.
Yeah.
And I was totally amazed. We got our rods out and went to it, and it was a nice way to wake up in the morning, that's for sure.
That's the fun of it, too. I mean, you're out there, you're doing a little exploring, and if you don't find fish, what have you really lost?
Right.
You've had a great day of walking and hiking and viewing the mountains, and, it's all in a day's work, I guess. Some days you have good days of fishing, some days you don't, but they're all better than spending it at home, so.
Right, right. Another question here. Some lakes look very deep and others quite shallow. how do you know where to fish?
Well, you know, when you're on top of it, it's always very difficult. But when you talk to anybody that fishes lakes, any real experts on lake fishing, it's always about structure. So when you see rocks, when you see ledges, when you see a change in color, that can be considered structure. I mean, even if you got this long, shallow, you know, sandy bank or sandy inlet into a lake, and then you just see a little dark spot drop off, and it may only drop off the foot. That can be structure. That's considered, you know, a possibility for fish. So it's always about structure. You know, changes in depth, changes in, and you see those changes in depth through changes in water color.
Mm-hmm.
And you just fish them.
Yeah, now last year we were up some high mountain lakes, and it was kind of what I would call a shelf going out, a real shallow shelf that probably was only a couple feet deep, you know, where you could see everything. There were a few fish there, and then there was a deep color drop-off, you know, and a color change to where it dropped off at depth. So along that edge, would you expect, are you saying that would be considered structure along that drop-off?
Yes,
and,
that's structure in a lake, correct.
Okay.
One more quick point on that is that, you know, you see a lot of people standing on shore and they cast out in the middle of the lake and then draw their fly or their, you know, bobber or whatever back straight at them. And your ability to catch fish will increase if you start angling your cast. It's not so much how far you cast it in some cases as it is that the angle that the fly is coming across the water. And maybe to clarify that, you're trying to find the depth that the fish are in. So if you cast straight out and you cast in 20 feet of water and it gradually comes up to 1 foot of water, you're bringing your fly through a distance. You know, if you let it go all the way to 18 or 19 feet and you start reeling the fly in, you're fishing at that certain depth the whole way, or no, you're changing depth as you fish that all the way back to shore. As if you were casting at an angle, you spend more time in one depth zone.
I see what you're saying.
Makes any sense. Do you know what I'm trying to say there? So I would be fishing along that ledge. You know, I would try to cast to that ledge and fish back along it in the direction of that ledge rather than casting across it and fishing over the top of it. Does that make sense?
Sure, sure. Okay. Not always easy to do, but
I know.
Given your situation, which kind of brings up a couple other questions about, you know, taking waders or belly boats up there. Do you do that, or do you?
I carried my fins and a float tube in once. And if it had been another mile up the trail, I think I'd have dropped them off and picked them up on the way back.
Yeah.
They did come out with some really light stuff. There was a little blow up, you know, like a three chamber blow up thing that was pretty quick. I never did get one and try it. I just decided to hoof it and take my chances.
Yeah. Okay.
I've tried
okay.
it, and it's just a ton of weight. It's just a lot of extra weight to carry out.
Right, right. What about time of day to fish the lakes? Do you find times of day better than others?
Well, you know, high mountain lakes, I guess you'd have to say morning is probably the best, but I've caught a lot of fish at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, too. So if there's some insect activity that, you know, the water warms up a little bit and you get a little insect activity, that can be, you know, actually better than in the morning. I would say the morning is your chance for the big fish. You know, if there's any real big fish in the lake, the morning is going to be the time they're going to be up cruising around looking. So.
Okay. One thing when my son and I were up last summer, again, you know, up at a high mountain lake, backpacked in, and we were just kind of, we weren't even fishing, actually. We didn't even bring any rods that trip. But, boy, right at just before dark, that lake came alive and real close into shore. I mean, like 10 feet from the shore. And so I think a lot of the, and it was based upon something hatching coming up, and they were sipping them off. But I think those fish all came in when it got dark and came very close to shore.
Yeah.
So I kind of learned a lesson there that might be a, you know, next time we go, a great time to be fishing that lake. And that was when they were only in a couple feet of water, too, you know. It wasn't deep there. So, yeah. The other thing we noticed, too, is as we were crossing some little creeks that were exiting the lake, just little kind of dribbles of water, there's all kinds of fish in those little streamlets, so to speak. You know, as you walk across, you hear fish moving and skirting out, and it's amazing what little water they're in there.
Yeah, they'll get in there. You can definitely step across some of these things, and fish are right under your feet.
Yeah. Well, do you have a lot of this water is definitely crystal clear up there. Do you have any like stealth tactics to get close to these fish without them seeing you?
Well, you know, I don't know anybody that can really go in and not spook a fish once in a while. It's just something that's going to happen. But I think if you just watch your shadow, you know, especially in those early morning or late, you know, evening times, if you just make sure your shadow's not hitting the water, you know, the only thing that attacks fish, their only predation is going to be from up above, birds, eagles, and so forth. So that shadow is the prime thing that will spook the fish. You know, the other thing is your casting. If you can cast, you know, reasonably soft onto the water and you're not really splashing the water, that's going to be an advantageous to you. Maybe a longer leader, but like I said, I've been okay with 9-footers. That's about as long as I ever get. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I just think even though the water's clear, these fish are not line shy and leader shy like some fish that get regularly, you know, hammered.
They're used
to seeing that thing attached to something. So I think there's a little give and take there.
Right. Okay, we've got a question from Danny Drake in Colorado. Two questions, actually. Is ice out a good time to fish? Are the fish hungrier then?
I'm just going to say I think so. You know, I've fished ice out a couple times and done very well. So I've been there right before the ice is on and done very well too. So I'm going to say that they're ready. They're ready to eat. That's for sure.
Yeah. And is there any way to know whether a lake is iced out or not before you hike in?
Well, that's a little experience and, you know, maybe following the weather, but, if you had access to, you know, a government spy satellite or something to have them check it out for you, that would be my recommendation.
Well, and it's true, you never know about the weather. I know we were up going into the flat tops there, up by, do you know where Devil's Causeway is?
Yes.
Yeah, and, we were going over that saddle there and we met a couple of rangers coming out, and they asked us that, and this was the second week in July, and they asked us, are you ready for, are you prepared to do winter camping? And we said, we told them yes, of course, because we didn't want them to turn us back, but we weren't, and sure enough, as we went over that saddle, a snowstorm came in second week in July, and just hammered us for several hours, and soaked us to the bone, and it was kind of miserable, so you never know what you're going to get up there, even in the middle of the summer.
Weather is just an unpredictable thing up there. You know, you can have sunny skies all around you and just get poured on in the spot that you're sitting. So be careful about the weather.
Yeah, and the other thing is at when you're up there, you can't see it coming usually either.
That's right.
Because of the high ridges and so forth, it can be bright blue and then 10 minutes later be dark gray because you couldn't see that cloud coming in or that storm coming in. So you got to always be prepared for things like that.
And,
well, good.
It comes with an awesome light show, too, so be careful of the lightning.
Right. Lightning always has high country. You had mentioned the maps you used. What were they called?
Yeah, the Colorado Gazetteer. It's just that it's that big, you know, I don't know, 11 by 17 format or something.
Oh, yeah.
Big book. Yeah. I use some of the BLM maps, you know, if I'm going in, you know, the quick fold-ups. But my gazetteer, I just set it out, you know, on my desk and start looking through there and deciding where I want to try and what I want to, you know, try to accomplish. So
yeah.
That's my starting point.
So you do a lot of exploring kind of off the beaten track to find some of these places.
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's where you can find some real little jewels up there, I bet. Huh?
Yes. Lots of them, not to be mentioned.
Oh, well, thanks a lot, Marty. You were supposed to tell all your secrets tonight.
I gave you the flat tops.
The flat tops, yeah. I already knew about the flat tops, Marty. Okay. Well, listen, it's time to wrap things up. But stick with us here, folks. When we return, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, and a copy of Marty's book, Tying Flies Like a Pro. And did you have something else you were going to give away there, Marty?
Well, I have a DVD that I would send to somebody that answers maybe the question or at least gets a second email in to answer it.
Okay, great, great. Well, so we have another prize to look forward to. So thank you, Marty, and we will do that in just a few seconds. Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website, www.familyties, and that's TYES.com. FamilyTies.com, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Well, just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. Find a link on our homepage in the section under Marty's section there that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll enjoy reading your comments. Well, now it's time to give away our prizes, and the winners for our drawings are randomly selected from this show's registration database, and that was on the homepage. It's a little late to register now, but in the future you want to make sure you're registered on all our shows so that you can at least have a chance on a lot of these great prizes. So we're going to do the drawing first for a 3-year membership for the Federation of Fly Fishers, and so I'm going to do our random pick from the database. And we have Jack Grover in Idaho. Jack Grover gets the 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. So congratulations, Jack, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy that. If you're already a member, then we'll get you an extension to your membership. So, and you can find out more about the Federation of Fly Fishers by going to their website at www.fedflyfishers.org. It's www.fedflyfishers.org. But now we'll give away a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, which you can learn more about at www.flyfusionmag.com. That's flyfusionmag.com. Fly Fusion Magazine is out of Calgary, Canada. Beautiful magazine, has a lot of how-to and learning articles in there that you're going to enjoy. So let's see who the winner there is, and that is John French in California. John French won the subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. So congratulations, John. Marty's book, now you guys got to get ready on that homepage of ours and ready to submit your answers to this. Again, you got to give us a right answer, and you have to put your name and your location in there before to be able to win. Okay, here's the question. Marty told us what he thought the ideal weight rod was for high country fishing. So what's the ideal weight rod, and if you want to cast far, I'm going to complicate this, if you want to cast farther, what is the weight line you would put on it to get the maximum in a roll cast? So weight of rod, weight of line, go for it, guys and girls, and let's see who gets that. So you got to have both, weight of rod, weight of line. So Marty, I'm just checking here to see what's coming in here. Okay, we got a 5 weight with a stiff butt. That's Ed. And Ed didn't give me the line. He probably submitted it. I think a lot of these guys submitted it beforehand. So let's see. Well, 5 weight, that's wrong anyway, right?
I don't think that's right.
Okay. And the second one, Jeff Moody gave me, is a 5-weight. Here we go. We've got Mark Power in Halifax, Nova Scotia. He's got 4-weight.
And did he have a line weight?
No. I got a line weight here and a rod weight, but no name or location. So somebody won and we don't know who they are. Okay, I'm going to keep checking here.
Oh, no.
Okay, I got a 5-weight rod and a 6-weight line. We're still looking for the right answer, aren't we, Marty?
Well, if we don't get the right answer, that one is going to work.
I got one. I think this is it, Marty. 4-weight okay. With a 5-weight line.
That's the correct answer.
That's the combination, and guess who? It's the duct tape man, Phil Panko.
And we need to clarify that a little bit. That is for roll casting. You know,
right, right.
You want that little extra line weight to load that rod better. That's what you're
right. So Phil gets your book, and you said the second person that gave the correct answer would get a DVD, right?
Yes.
And I think we've got another... that's 5-weight, 6-weight, 3-weight, 4-weight. People are still guessing.
I don't think I mentioned the 3-weight, did I? I just said
no, no. I'm still looking. Everybody thinks it's 5-weight. Well, we were talking 4-weight, 5-weight. Okay. Ted Christie, Parker. I guess Parker, Colorado. 4-weight, 5-weight. He's the second person. So Ted Christie gets your DVD.
Okay.
And I think he's a local yokel here in Colorado, so.
I could probably throw that to him from where I'm at.
Well, that was a lie. We've never gone that far looking for the right answer, so that was a little tougher, I guess. But Phil Panko gets your book, and then Ted Christie gets a DVD. So congratulations, both of you, and thanks all of you for playing tonight. And thank you, Marty, for being on our show. We really appreciate you taking time out to be with us, and always a pleasure to talk with you.
I had a lot of fun. I got some interesting questions, and hopefully I was able to help somebody tonight.
Well, I'm sure you did, and we always learn something, and there's always something to learn. That's the great thing about fly fishing. Well, our next broadcast will be on May 7th, and on that show, it's going to be at 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, we're going to have a real treat. We're going to be interviewing Dave Whitlock. And our topic for the show is a little unusual. It's, why did Dave Whitlock move to Oklahoma? So Dave moved to Oklahoma for several reasons, but the Lower Illinois River is one of them, where he caught 17 varieties of fish in one day. You won't want to miss this interview. It's with one of the fly fishing's most notable figures. He is quite the man, quite the artist, quite the writer. Everybody, you better be on there live, because this is going to be a once-in-a-lifetime type of interview. So look forward to doing it. But we'd like to thank Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Platte River Fly Shop, Keeney's Fly Shop, and Power Fibers for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-888-961-1115, extension 2, and we'll be happy to explain the options that are available to you. Don't forget to visit our website, AskAboutFlyFishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.